The last thing I'll say is that target people that have invested in companies like yours. People have predisposed biases to either believe or not believe in certain things. It's unlikely they're going to wake up one day and be like, let's change our business model and do something outside of the box.
This is Can Do, a podcast that explores the business lessons essential for success in these volatile times. Can Do shares the insights of industry experts, along with the experiences and advice of local businessmen and businesswomen. Whether you're a business owner, an entrepreneur, or your career is affected by the current economic climate, these lessons will give you the guidance you need to make informed decisions about your future. I'm your host, Arnie Sherman. Over the past 5 years, Montana has seen exponential growth in venture capital investment. From 2015 to 2020, the state attracted over $500 million in early stage funding. In the previous 20 years, that figure had been just $144 million. Next Frontier Capital has played a central role in this growth. Founded in 2015 in Bozeman, Montana, and focusing on the tech sector in Colorado, Utah, and Montana, the fund invests in scaling companies up from concept to exit. In Montana alone, an infusion of $28.4 million from NFC has attracted an additional $174 million in outside funding. Today on Can Do, Will Price and Michael Fitzgerald join us for an update. Price, whom we last spoke with in 2019, is co-founder and general partner of Next Frontier Capital. Fitzgerald, a guest in 2018, chairs the board of Submittable, a provider of submissions management software solutions. Submittable was one of the early beneficiaries of Next Frontier funding. Will and Michael help us examine the investment paradigm from both a funder and recipient perspective and how the pandemic has influenced the process. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise, representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. Welcome to the show today, Will Price and Michael Fitzgerald.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Will, tell us a little bit about Next Frontier Capital.
Next Frontier Capital was started in 2015 with a principal mission to fund Montana companies of innovation, utility, and value, but also to fundamentally address a imbalance that we saw between the strength of the entrepreneurship that existed in the state and the lack of capital that was allocated to support those founders. I would say that historically, venture capital has been a parochial business that really invested in its backyard, and the backyards where capital were aggregated were San Francisco, Palo Alto, Seattle, New York, Boston. And if you lived as an entrepreneur outside of those geographic areas, we had this very difficult challenge of either to move to those markets to build your company or really sacrifice opportunity and go a different route. And so we saw an opportunity to support entrepreneurs between the coasts, as it were, and created a company to do that here in Montana.
And by being here, just by that fact alone, did that allow a new kind of influx of money in the area?
It did. The key thing that I think happens is that big institutional capital is using quantitative metrics to evaluate and look at risk. So it's like, how fast is your revenue growing? How long does the customer stay with you? What does it cost to acquire a customer? And so while there is capital that's interested in investing outside of those coastal regions, it's contingent on being able to reach a certain level of quantitative performance to attract capital. So if you're a startup founder with an idea or maybe a prototype or a set of early customers with no real meaningful traction, you don't have enough there to get those people interested. So by being local, we could better assess founders' capabilities, look beyond the numbers to the founding mission, the people behind the company, some of those early customers and why they were interested in buying, and partner with founders to take them from those early beginnings to a point where national capital would be interested. So being here was fundamentally required to do that.
Will, you just raised $80 million for a fund number three. What will you use that money for?
The $80 million is, to me, it's a miraculous number, because we started with 21 in 2015, and that was something that I thought, well, geez, you know, venture capital in Montana, is that like military intelligence, oxymoron? You know, like, are people really going to take our state seriously? So $20 million was a real accomplishment, I felt. The next fund was $38 million, and then this fund is $80 million, as you said, Arnie. And it's 100% dedicated to investing in entrepreneurs. So we're looking for quality founders of mostly software companies, but also we do what we call deep tech, which is like LiDAR systems, optical computing, quantum computing, kind of the leading edge of where hardware is going. But the mandate has shifted slightly from our first fund because we now consider companies anywhere in the Rocky Mountains. So we'll make investments in Spokane and Boise, in Boulder, Colorado, in Salt Lake City, and of course here in Montana. So the fund is dedicated to this region and to entrepreneurs of that type.
Michael, first off, how are you feeling? For our listeners, Michael has been living with colorectal cancer.
I'm fine, thank you. I'm as good as you could possibly be, I think.
That's great. You were one of the early entrepreneurs that Will invested in. Can you tell us a little bit about the VC process as a fund seeker?
Yeah, so I think Will kind of addressed this a little bit, but you know, one of the biggest problems, I didn't really understand this at the time, was when you started a company 10 years ago, there was pretty exciting angel funds like Frontier Fund and Liz Markey and a lot of amazing people trying to get people startups. But there wasn't follow-on capital. And Will can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but in my opinion, what he did was sort of create that bridge, and it's dramatically changed the startup landscape. There just wasn't, like, everybody could kind of raise maybe $50,000, and I'm making it sound that's not a lot of money, but there was nothing after that. And that has dramatically changed, and it's because of people like Will and Next Frontier. I can say when we first started, we had no idea what we were doing, but I was very fortunate to meet some of what I think of as early entrepreneurs in Missoula, like Steve Saroff and Glenn Kreisel and a couple others. And they, more than money, they sort of told me how you do it when you're doing it out in the cold.
So when you started Submittable, you didn't know what you were doing, but tell our listeners what Submittable is doing.
Yeah, I'm going to back that up a little bit. I didn't know what I was doing in terms of raising capital and sort of creating a company. I knew how to write software. My partners were both very skilled software engineers. And I knew about the problem because I was a novelist, and our first market was publishers. And so it was pretty clear to me that it would work and someone was going to do it. And so we just did it. It has dramatically expanded since from that first product and first vision. Originally, we were just focused on publishers who had this problem once everything went from analog to digital, from accepting digital manuscripts. Essentially, it became effortless to send them work and very challenging to read and review it. And Submittable had a solution for that. And it took off, and it was great. The mechanics of accepting a document and reviewing it has many other use cases. Most recently, we started seeing a lot of organizations using us for grant application management. So any application process that has a digital object, what we call a digital object attached, such as a document, a PowerPoint, or an Excel sheet, Submittable was built for that review process. People think we're a form builder, but it's really about how to collaborate and score documents once they come into your organization. And grant applications, we got into about 3 or 4 years ago, just customers came to us, you know, we didn't even really know it existed. And it has exploded, you know, especially in 2020. In 2019, $1.7 billion was deployed from independent foundations. So if you think of mom and pop foundations, but also corporations have foundations. And that doubled in 2020 to more than doubled to $4.7 billion. And corporations are all stepping into the social impact space. And I think was $9.7 billion in deployment of capital into what they consider social causes. And then the government with PPP, and last year alone, I think they deployed over $4 trillion. So Submittable has sort of, we tiptoed into it, but it exploded in the last year. And we recently expanded our offerings to do all kinds of social impact. So we are becoming a social impact platform rather than just reviewing documents.
Will, it's exciting to see what Submittable is doing now, but initially, what was it about Submittable that made it a good match for Next Frontier Capital?
Great question. We met at the business school competition at the University of Montana, the business school. We were sitting next to each other, and it was just, you know, we just started talking, and I said, Michael, tell me about the business. What are you guys doing? And they had some pedigree that I think got caught my eye. For example, they were the only Montana company that I know of that's been to Y Combinator, and they graduated in 2012. So Y Combinator, for your listeners, is the premier accelerator for startup founders. And so they've spawned companies like Dropbox and Airbnb and Stripe, really that have changed computing and how we use the internet. And so I was like, well, that's really interesting. And then the second thing that really caught my eye was that they had hundreds and hundreds of customers, but yet didn't have any sales and marketing. I mean, it was really a credit card based purchase process. You would go to the website, say, hey, I have that problem. You know, let's say I'm a poetry magazine or I'm a film competition. I'm getting all these submissions in there. I'm being overwhelmed. How do I organize them? How do I assign them to reviewers? How do I get people to, how do I respond to all the people that have sent me these things? And I really felt like they were onto something from a product workflow perspective. And whenever you see a company that doesn't invest professionally in sales and marketing, yet is growing revenue rapidly, you know you're onto something. And so my thesis was that Mike will be a great partner to work with, that there was an opportunity to invest in sales and marketing to either further accelerate the growth. And, you know, frankly, given our first fund, we had an exclusive focus on Montana. It was, you know, I think in the top two companies, three companies in Montana at the time. And so for me, it was very much on mission. I really loved Michael and his founding team, Bruce and John. And so we were lucky enough to convince them to work with us. And we made our investment in 2015.
Michael, so how do you get your customers?
We just kind of put ourselves out there. You know, we leaned on the fact we were from Montana. You know, people wanted to talk to us because you just don't see enterprise software coming out of Montana at the time. There was what we did then. What Will's talking about is that we were primarily a no-touch company. You know, people would come to the website, put in their credit card, and be up and running. And that was, you know, we built that from a product focus in the beginning because we were all engineers. We didn't really know how to do enterprise sales. And so our goal was really to like not talk to customers, to build a product so effortless to use, so user-focused that once you were in, it was just working. And that has paid off in spades because it now that we do have a large sales team and we do have all the sort of trappings of enterprise software, we can also stand up the platform still in seconds. Because of that work we did in the beginning, we now win deals because we can get the state of Montana up and running in a week or 2 weeks, as where competition, a large enterprise deploy can take 3 months. But in the beginning, we got it. You know, I was a novelist, and so I kind of was very comfortable writing, and we wrote blog posts. I mean, some of them were a little, you know, we suggested we were taking on Amazon, and you know, we just sort of put ourselves out there and made noise. And luckily we had, you know, we had an offering that worked for people. And once you get inside a small niche, you know, I think about this with when I talk to people starting companies now and they're bummed out about like, you know, this might be the perfect application for say sales or for, I don't know, marine biologists or something. And they are nervous about the market size. But to me, the most important thing are your first 10 customers. Like, how do you get from 1 to 10 to 100? And it's much easier if you are hyper, hyper focused on a niche, no matter how, even if it's, you know, fairly small. And then once you, you know, have that kind of churning underneath you, you can kind of build into these other industries. But I mean, we did everything. We like made stupid t-shirts. I mean, one of the greatest moments early on was when I was walking down the street in Brooklyn and I saw, at the time we were called Smish Mash, I saw a young person wearing a Smish Mash t-shirt. And I don't know, I didn't say anything to him, but I kind of wanted to like tackle him and hug him.
Michael, could you walk us through a typical kind of client engagement?
Sure. So, you know, we do, because, you know, one of the other things that paid off was because the application was plug and play in the beginning, we do have thousands of clients. We have probably over 10,000 clients. And, you know, the brand is out there. It is in organizations. It's in pretty much every university in the country, in one department or another. So we get a lot of inbound, which is a very fortunate thing, because I think what most founders will tell you at a certain stage is marketing and actually building the product used to be the biggest challenge, you know, probably in 2000. I think Constant Contact, I remember watching a talk from Gale, I can't remember her last name, but the CEO, you know, they spent something like $30 million building the original product. And that's before they started spending on marketing. And now to me, marketing and advertising is the biggest expense, you know, and until recently, real estate. So, you know, VCs were basically, they could have just written the checks directly to Google and landlords. So a client either comes in and then we do a, you know, we try to figure out what, you know, what their potential is as a client, what products that we're serving or selling them might be a good fit. And if they're on the higher end of enterprise, you know, we start a, we reach out to them. We want to talk to them in person. So we, you know, it's a much more complicated, they generally have much more complicated needs. So we need to talk to them in person to see if we're a good fit for them, to see if the price is good for them. And then we might bring in a sales engineer if we're going to do anything custom. And a lot of the first iterations are just listening to them, listening to what goals they're trying to meet. You know, no one wakes up and says, oh, I want to buy Submittable. Somebody wakes up and says, oh, I've got this problem. And how do I solve it? You know, the first few phone calls aren't us talking about our product or telling you how to what you should buy. It's mostly listening. And then you get into the nitty gritty and sort of hammer out something that works for everybody. You know, the best negotiations are everyone comes away a little bit happy. But you're hopefully getting into a long-term relationship, and you know, that's pretty much it.
So Will, Michael and Submittable's no-touch solution lends itself pretty well to a COVID pandemic in terms of the ability to keep moving forward and growing. But how has, in general, the COVID pandemic affected Next Frontier Capital and your portfolio companies?
It's a very good question. And I would say that a year ago, people thought that the pandemic would mean a recession, an economic slowdown, a delay of decision making. And we were all preparing, I think, for nuclear winter a little bit. What's happened, if you look at the stock market, you know, at the end of last year, that none of that proved true. And I think what really saved the technology industry is that technology is the way to automate and digitally transform businesses. And there was a lot of inertia in the current way of doing business that COVID forced you no longer to tolerate. Let's just, for example, look at what we're doing right now. We're on a Zoom meeting. Historically, we would have been met at a studio. We would all have been together. And that was the best practice for doing so. And certainly there's compromises not being together, maybe audio quality, the, you know, the ability to look at each other in person. But COVID forced a reassessment to say, how are we going to work in a distributed fashion? How are we going to be able to automate more tasks? And I think it's led to a massive investment and acceleration in digitally transforming how we all live, work, and play. As it relates to Next Frontier, because we're exposed to the enterprise software sector, that was countercyclical. Investments were going into software rather than away from software. It accelerated our business. Our companies have grown faster, Submittal being a prime example. The second thing it's done is that, you know, as Michael said earlier, like Montana was considered the hinterlands, and it's given us a level of a level playing field where it doesn't really matter where you work anymore. You know, if you have an internet connection, distribution is becoming a de rigueur, if you will, for companies. So companies like Shopify and Stripe and Twitter and Salesforce and Airbnb and Facebook and Microsoft have all gone remote. In many cases, they're going to continue to go remote even after COVID wanes. It's our ability to attract talent into our market, our ability for companies to build here but have people distributed all over the country and have that not be questioned. You know, it used to be like if you didn't have a headquarters where people come and visit and see everyone working in a building, they would wonder what's happening. It's been completely culturally and accepted from a business community now to have distributed work and environment. So, you know, in summary, the fact that we're investing in enterprise software, which is all about automation, digital transformation, and efficiency, live in a place like Montana that's a net population gainer during a pandemic, and then our companies can be built here but employ people all over the world or all over the country without being second-guessed or questioned why they would do that. It's been a, unfortunately to say it, because it's come through a lot of pain for a lot of people, it's been a positive thing for our business.
Michael, what adjustments has Submittable made as a result of the pandemic?
As a result of the pandemic. So as Will said in the beginning, it was pretty scary. And I do think decision-making kind of froze for about a month. We had a bumpy a year ago, April. We did some layoffs for the first time, and mostly out of just fear of the future and we didn't know if capital was going to still be there for the next round. And The biggest change has been the market. Originally through, I mean, we got there through grant management, but now do this social impact. And I don't think that opportunity would have been so glaring if we hadn't, you know, run into COVID. It is horrible that it took something as bad as COVID to for these opportunities to surface, but it's been very, very good for us. You know, we've doubled in revenue, doubled in size. There's a lot of wind in our sails. It's been just very exciting.
And how big a company is Submittable now?
I think we're at about 110 right now.
And are most of those people at least working and living in the Missoula area?
No, I would say 30% are remote, or, you know, there's people all over Montana, but we also have people in Phoenix, people in Chicago. You know, and that was another thing that COVID sort of nudged us into is remote. And it was a great timing because we put a big push on engineering, on doubling our engineering team this year. And that has always been a challenging thing to do in Missoula. You know, we can get, you know, amazing salespeople, but senior engineers, engineering managers, people who have managed engineers before, that's been more of a challenge. And once we opened it up to remote, we were able to get just world-class people. And it's been pretty exciting.
Well, Michael just talked about, you know, getting world-class people and, you know, working remotely has changed that. Montana is sort of becoming a nexus for, you know, venture capital. What are the obstacles for it really becoming everything it could be?
I think there are a couple that I can think of. One is political. Tech is a progressive industry that is historically been extremely opposed to any legislation or actions that prejudice the rights of minorities or disadvantaged groups. I'm thinking specifically about bathroom bills, gender bills. And you know, this legislative session, there are bills in Helena that I think if they were to be passed and enforced, could see at a top-down level, like I'm talking about corporate decision-making about where to allocate resources, open offices, make investments that would prejudice and prevent our industry from fulfilling its potential. If you look at Indiana and North Carolina after they passed gender identity or bathroom bills, they lost huge investments. PayPal pulled out of North Carolina, Salesforce pulled out of investment in North Carolina. Indianapolis suffered from it. So to me, you know, Montana's always been a libertarian state. And even though it's been purple, historically, it's not been a social state where social legislation is pursuing social objectives. And I've made it clear, and Michael's made it clear, and the high tech business community has made it clear to Governor Gianforte and to our legislatures that these types of legislative acts will put a bullseye on our backs that say we are not a state that's friendly to disadvantaged or underrepresented minorities. And it will be something that becomes a litmus test for where people want to choose to work. And I still think we may gain some population just because of the nature of the work, but it would materially slow down, I think, the investment pace here, particularly top-down investment case. Like when Salesforce is saying, let's put an office somewhere, or Facebook or Google, these are going to be criteria by which they'll evaluate on top of broadband access, you know, how many direct flights are there, how much is housing, quality of education. And so that's particularly relevant to us today as the legislators meeting in Helena and the bills are advancing through the legislative process.
I totally agree, Arnie, and with what Will's saying. And we've lost amazing potential applicants or candidates for jobs because of our politics in the last couple of months, even before that.
And it's something that really isn't initially planned for. It's not in a business plan generally. And all of a sudden this thing comes along and it does have a tremendous impact. As you said, not only a bullseye on your back, but you know, people are looking at where they want to work and these kinds of judgments and these kinds of, you know, greater community visions become important to, you know, sought after employees.
No question about it. And I would say diversity in general is a challenge sometimes in Montana. I mean, we all know that we're a heavily Caucasian state. And so, and Michael and I have talked about this in the past, if you're recruiting people from different ethnic backgrounds, they worry like, am I going to be comfortable there? Will my family be safe there? I think for the most part, we can address those issues. But it is a top of mind concern. And if you look at the tech industry in general, it's highly diverse and represented by significant numbers of ethnic minorities in very meaningful positions and really important contributors to the overall success. So keeping Montana open, welcoming, safe for people that feel threatened, and not having legislation that targets them, I think is something that we need to stand for.
Tech has always had an issue about gender balance and getting women in the tech sector. Michael, Will, you know, how's that been progressing?
Yeah, we've been very fortunate with getting incredibly strong female employees in pretty much every department. At the C-level in engineering, which has been traditionally hard. Now, engineering can always be improved, but, you know, women can would know better than me, but or not, you know, non-men could, would know better than me, but we have not had a problem with gender as much as ethnicity. You know, it's just very challenging to convince a 40-year-old with maybe a child, you know, maybe kids who aren't Caucasian to move to a place where everybody else is, or whether and put their kids in that school. And I do hope it's changing, but it's challenging, and you're not going to create a global company unless you can do that.
We're speaking with Will Price of Next Frontier Capital and Michael Fitzgerald of Submittable. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by Montana Rail Links, committed to safely delivering transportation solutions to their customers and partners. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. Well, when you're looking at a company to invest in, I mean, you have 35-plus companies in your portfolio. What are the red flags that you look for in terms of what might cause failure or what might not allow a company to achieve its potential?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, typically a couple things really come to mind. I really think the founding team being mission driven is really important. And for example, a lot of people think I'll do a startup and I'll make a lot of money. It's a very hard thing to do to build a company. Michael's his gray hair is evidence of that. And, you know, there's a lot of rejection. You're trying to create something out of nothing. And there's a lot of impediments for that, for being successful, whether it's building the wrong product or customers not having budget or going with a competition or not being able to hire good people. And so to me, what sustains you through that struggle is this calling or conviction that what you're doing needs to happen and the world will be a better place for it. And so that's a positive motivation because you're trying to change the world for the better. If you're negatively motivated, you're doing it for money or for ego, a satisfaction, or because you think that it's something you should do. When you get into the struggle, those are negative motivations, you know, because all of a sudden you're acting out of obligation or fear or sense of responsibility for the people's money you've taken, and you're not going to be at your best. So one thing as we look at is what's driving this behavior? Why did you start this company? The second thing I think is just the ability to get along with somebody and to create trust with them and to build an intimate relationship where they're willing to share truth with you and vice versa. And so if someone is not a good listener or is very defensive or it's never their fault or they don't take feedback well, they're not coachable, I think that can be a big concern as well. Beyond the people issues and the founding mission, the other thing that we tend to shy away from is people that are not productive with spending money. Michael is an incredibly frugal founder. He would sleep on a couch rather than stay in an expensive fancy hotel to save money for the company. And he viewed the company's assets as, you know, as something that he spent very, very carefully. And so when you see people that have taken a lot of money but not gotten very far, that tends to be a red flag as well. Not a productive return on investment. And so how much capital they've raised to get to certain milestones. For example, you meet a company that's gotten a couple $1 million in revenue on $500,000 investment. You're like, wow, this is a really interesting company. How did they do that? Versus someone who's raised $4 million and not really delivered anything. That would be another red flag. The other one I think is just, you know, because it comes down to people, is what's the founder relationship like? Do they have co-founders? Do they get along? Do they trust each other? Do they work functionally together? And so those are some of the things that we look for, Arnie.
Michael, many companies face issues like health challenges, and it's rarely talked about. You know, you've been living with cancer for a number of years now, and it has changed your position in the company from CEO and you know, day-to-day operation to moving to chairman. What impact has that really had on Submittable?
I think it's, you know, the new CEO, Thor Culverhouse, has done something that I couldn't have done. And, you know, I can kind of compartmentalize the stepping back from CEO position. It was definitely time, like, as a chairman and as a shareholder, like, I am very glad he is in the position than I am. He's just done it before. He sort of knows the mechanics of a company at this stage that I didn't know. And there's more at stake. You know, we have 100 employees, all their kids, and I feel better having somebody who's done it before. I like to think that, you know, that original id or the core personality of the company is still there. And I think it is in terms of, you know, being able to talk to, you know, we do 7-figure deals now and I wasn't able to do those. And I'm not sure I was able to, you know, we have some incredible salespeople, but in the beginning everybody was learning how to do it. And we brought in experienced people who've done it before. And to me, it's, you know, one of the most gratifying things is, you know, I have someone who is a cashier at the good food store, and not to take away from that position, but they are now out there closing 6- and 7-figure deals. And, you know, it's dramatically changed their lives. They have health insurance. They own a house. Seeing that happen more and more at Submittable has been a very exciting thing for me this year. I don't know if it would have happened at the same pace if I was still the CEO.
Will, a lot of the companies you have invested in and continue to invest in are tech companies that don't require, you know, high touch, but some of their customers do require that. And the pandemic has had a, you know, devastating effect on some of those industries. What can you do? What can your tech companies do to help those companies, you know, come out of all of this in a better way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, when you look at a risk of a business, a couple of things you would look at would be diversity of revenue. Like, what are your revenue sources? For example, what's your customer concentration risk? Does one customer dominate your revenue mix? Let's say 30, 40% of your revenue. And then you could also look at sector risk. Like, how exposed are you to travel? How exposed are you to the hospitality industry, the restaurant industry, what have you? And I would say that there's no question that certain sectors of the economy absolutely have been impacted so adversely. I'm thinking particularly about hotels and travel and music venues and things like that. And so I think it's once you're in that situation, it's very hard to pivot out of it because you've built your collateral, your sale, your product, your reputation in certain industries. But as a business rule, coming out of COVID, what you could learn from would be to be aware of how concentrated you are in certain sectors or how concentrated you are against certain customers. And to always have a plan to never get too uncomfortably concentrated. And it can be a function of an industry going south. Obviously, the pandemic is kind of an act of God. You can't really forecast it. But you certainly can do things about saying, like, this customer is getting awfully large in our mix, or this sector is really dominating our business. And how do we think about that? And so as a proactive approach, that would be one thing to do. Now, once you're in that situation and the market turns against you, like, for example, if you were supposed to travel, you know, I think the only thing you can do, and what we helped our companies think through, were some very, very difficult decisions. One, can you reduce your expenses? And typically in a tech industry, that's about 70% of your expenses are people. And so it's immediately thinking about cutting people. And that's a very sad thing to have to think through. But a lot of our companies had to make that decision this time last year. The second thing would be that the government was proactive in terms of PPP loans. And so thinking about what are the sources of liquidity and capital you can access. And a lot of our companies went forward and applied for PPP. Those PPP loans allowed us to maintain our employee headcount. And those loans are mostly forgivable. I think 90% of them are forgivable as long as you meet the certain criteria. And so thinking through government programs that can help you. And then where those aren't available, but you still have a business that has enduring value, being able to raise more equity through your existing investors to get you through the process. And those are all things that we had to do with some of our companies to help them get through it.
Michael, you've been through the VC process with Next Frontier Capital and other sources as well. What tips do you have for companies that are out there looking to be recipients of venture capital?
Build something that makes people happy and they're willing to pay for. But with, you know, through the actual pitch process, that, you know, it's rarely personal, and I actually really enjoyed it. Many of these people are extremely smart, and I often come away with insights into my own company that I didn't before. Don't get defensive. Actually, Will wrote a great blog post, was it yesterday, I think, about presentations. And, you know, essentially don't get defensive, don't get evasive. They've seen everything. So, you know, it'd be very challenging to hide something from them. Be open, get it over with as soon as possible. You might be building a long-term relationship and you're going to partner with this person for potentially, you know, 5 to 10 years. You just want to be open, demonstrate who you are as a person, demonstrate like why you, you know, what your conviction is about the market or the thing you've built, and just go. I don't know.
Will, would you like to add something to that?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, one of the things I think about is a long process. So you got to invest time in the process and prepare for it. You know, and I think we try to help our companies think in 3 to 6 months time frames. The second thing, you got to have early on a broad set of targets you want to go talk to, maybe 20 or 30 different firms, and you have to think about strategies for how you get access to those people. That's where people like me can be helpful. Then I think you want to try to lump them all together so all of the people you're talking to are going through the process at the same time. And that way, the benefits of each meeting kind of are paid across all the meetings. But also if someone kind of gets to a decision, say they want to do something, the other bidders also are roughly at the same context and awareness of it. And the other thing I would say is that there are so many investors out there that you can't extrapolate from any one experience to the next experience. I remember when we raised the True Ventures round with Michael, which they're a great firm. There were other people that passed based on geography or based on size of the company, but True leaned in and saw something. And you never know who's going to be the one that says, wow, this is one I want to get involved with. And last thing I would just say is just like Michael said, just don't take anything personally. You know, people are going to say things that about your baby, you know, and about what you're putting your life effort into, but you just have to view it as they've got context and set of experiences and pattern recognition that's telling them something, and you should try to learn from it. And last thing I'll say is that target people that have invested in companies like yours, that people have predisposed biases to either believe or not believe in certain things. And so if you're talking to a company that's never invested out of the Bay Area, for example, or never done, in Michael's case, like kind of an SMB consumer type sale where it was credit card driven as opposed to top down sales driven, it's unlikely they're going to wake up one day and be like, let's change our business model and do something outside of the box. So identifying people that have a predisposition to believe in you and believe in the types of business that you represent. And then just steel yourself for being really iterative in your material. Like, you'll get better as you pitch. The pitch will get tighter. The data they want to ask, the questions that you'll be asked, you'll have better, more prepared answers for. You know, and the hard thing about doing it, I think, as a CEO is your team is so interested. Like, well, how did it go? What's going on? And are we going to get a term sheet from this firm? Why did those guys pass? Does that mean our company's not any good? And so you got to control the anxiety level of the company in a way that, you know, you don't want to be someone who's a total Cassandra, like, you know, everything's going to be great, or Pollyannish, I should say, probably. But at the same time, you want to be real with people. And so prepare your company for the process, knowing there'll be ups and downs, but ultimately you're going to probably get to a good place without scaring them that why it hasn't happened yet. And what does that mean for my payroll? Because most of these companies are running out of money, right? So you are looking at a cliff and you're trying to fill that challenge, but without panicking. So those are tough things to do.
if I can also add, state when you're targeting, like, focus on, you know, most funds both have a thesis about what they invest in, but also a stage that they're focused on. And I've made the mistake of talking to firms that were Series C when I was Series B and that kind of thing.
Michael, Will, it's great catching up with you. You know, I wish you continued health and success, and talk to you again soon.
You too, Arnie. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Really fun.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, produced by Peter Hoag and Beth Ann Ostine in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments or recommendations for future guests or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guests' contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time when I'll talk with Bob Burns, president of Stockman's Bank in Missoula, Montana. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you good health and prosperity.